I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Dan Gardner joins me again. He's the co-author of a brilliant book, one that's gotten great notices and is a bestseller, Super Forecasting, the Art and Science of Prediction. It's written with Philip E. Tetlock, the Canadian-born academic who is a professor in the psychology and political science departments at the Wharton School of Business. The book relies on the research that Tetlock undertook with the Good Judgment Project, a study he co-leads with his wife, Barbara Mellers. Their study looks at the forecasts ordinary volunteers make and how they're just as good as, say, those marquee pundits we see in the media or even those made by intelligence analysts at big corporations or high up in government. The book is terribly engaging and in how super forecasters work and why we believe them. Dan Gardner has been on before for his two previous books, Risk and Future Babble. He has won numerous awards for his journalism. He is the editor of Policy Options. His website is at dangardner.ca. The book is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program in Ottawa today, Dan Gardner. Mr. Gardner, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So I remember in Future Babble you cited some of Tetlock's work. Did you know him well then when you wrote that?
Not terribly well. I, of course, got in contact with Phil to discuss his work so I could better understand it, and he was also kind enough to sort of review the manuscript of Future Babble as it was in preparation, and I guess they'll like my work, and so he said, I've got this big new research project, and I'd like to do a book about it, and how about we do it together?
So the success of the book from the great notices and its sales thus far suggests that people are looking for answers. So does this book perhaps change how people approach predictions, especially those that we see regularly in the media, usually from certain pundits?
Well, I certainly hope it would change it, because there's a lot that needs to be changed. Basically, there are two thrusts to the book. One is the necessity of keeping score, to figure out what works and what doesn't. And then two is, well, what do we know coming out of Phil's research program about what works and what doesn't? That sort of larger issue about keeping score is something that I don't think most people quite understand, and I think that in part because when I first started researching this field, I remember quite vividly the first time I was told that the CIA and the other agencies of the U.S. intelligence community spend an immense amount of money on forecasting, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Very important forecasting. It's the stuff that actually informs decisions in the White House. And yet, nobody actually checks to see how accurate that forecasting is. There's literally no proper analysis of its accuracy, which seems pretty astonishing when you put it that boldly. And what's even more astonishing is that that's not unusual. In fact, corporations routinely spend huge amounts of money. Governments spend huge amounts of money on forecasting, and they have no idea how good that forecasting is because nobody keeps score. Nobody does the proper analysis needed to determine its accuracy. And in the book, we make the argument that what that essentially means is that a large swaths of forecasting, which is so important because it informs all the big decisions that we make, mm-hmm. large swaths of this forecasting is rather like pre-scientific medicine. It's stuff that's done on hunch and feeling and intuition and expert authority, but do we really know if it works or not? And the answer is no, and that's ridiculous, and that's really got to change.
So, and governments and businesses, I mean, they keep using the same forecasters. So, are there people, are there firms, say, that you have found in the course of writing this book, with Professor Tetlock that say heed the warnings that you provide in the book?
Oh, there are elements of forecasting here and there that are what you would call scientific, which is to say that they keep score, they test, yeah. they analyze their results. We use as the exemplar of this meteorology. It's kind of funny because people make jokes about weather forecasts, but the fact is, meteorology and weather forecasts are the gold standard for how forecasting should be done. They're constantly tested. Meteorologists know how good their models are. know that because they're scientifically tested. There are other fields where that also happens. Some finance, for example, because typically they're using numbers, which makes it is very conducive to scorekeeping. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be better in those terms. But even there, even on Wall Street, even in the city in London, the level of rigor and analysis that goes into forecasting isn't what you would expect it would be, given how important those forecasts are.
So why do we then? I mean, is there something that goes on in our heads that we constantly rely on certain forecasting that and a lot of it that is bunk?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, it's, again, to think of it in terms of the history of medicine. You know, for thousands of years, it was extremely important that we figure out which medicine actually works. There were a few subjects that were more important when you're sick. And yet, in all that time, people did not figure out that they actually needed to do proper scientific testing to determine whether a treatment actually worked or not. Why was that? It's because of the intersection of our psychology with what you would call establishments and expertise and authority. So if you have people who are widely considered to be experts, and they have a compelling story that explains why this treatment works, that's pretty compelling stuff to our psychology. And throughout the entire history of medicine, people were satisfied. They said that was enough. It's only in literally the last 50 years that people began to realize, no, that's not enough. We've actually got to do proper scientific testing. Otherwise, you don't really know whether the treatment works or not. And it's the same thing with forecasting. When you have somebody who is an eminent person, whether it's a pundit in the news or it's a big Wall Street name or whoever, who comes along and says, I am an eminent person and here is my compelling story about what's going to happen, that's very compelling to our psychology. That's very satisfying. It's only if you think very carefully and very hard that you realize, you know, that's actually not good enough. I need to know what your track record is. How good is your forecasting? Don't tell me a story. Give me a percentage. I want to know how accurate your forecasts are. Very few people ever think to ask that, and that's what's got to change.
It's gotten to the point where I remember, you know, I follow you on Twitter, and there are certain pundits that you don't follow and that you don't take great stock in, that you've called out numerous times, you know, I tend to agree with some of the criticism sometimes, and you know, I took a pass recently at being offered a guest on the show because you've pointed out that whatever he's said just doesn't come to pass, doesn't, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the important point is that no matter how many times their forecasts fail, it never actually damages their careers, Bill Kristol being the classic example. I like to say that if Bill Kristol, you know, tells me that the sun will rise in the east tomorrow, I will seriously doubt that because he has such an amazing track record of being wrong. And it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Accuracy doesn't matter to the career of a pundit, which, of course, the media are a particularly extreme example, but this is it's a general phenomenon. And, you know, I wish people would sort of ask themselves, you know, to really think hard about whether that makes any sense, because a good illustration is a sports, right? Baseball. If you look at baseball, it's so statistically sophisticated that, you know, anytime a batter goes up to the plate, up on the Jumbotron, up pops a whole bunch of statistics about that person's performance. Anytime a general manager decides to hire or fire a player, it's all a question of, well, what do the stats tell us about this player's performance? The average fan sitting at a bar drinking beer and talking about who's a good player and who's not will rhyme off statistics. They won't simply say, hey, do you remember that time you made that great catch? No, they know they have to have the statistics in order to really judge their performance. If we could just have that same level of sophistication in forecasting, we would change things dramatically. And it's really quite spectacular, isn't it, that we are so much more demanding, we're so much more rigorous in our thinking when it comes to sports that don't matter than we are when it comes to forecasting that informs the most important decisions.
Now, you've got sports fans listening to us who probably wildly disagree with saying that sports isn't important.
Well, importance is relative. Yeah. I don't want to dismiss it entirely, but it is true. Yeah. If you look at, I've been so impressed, because I'm not so much a sports fan, mm-hmm. but when I listen to sports fans talk, particularly yeah. today, the level of sophistication is great and growing rapidly.
Yeah,
it's really quite impressive, and I just wish that we could do the same thing with forecasting that informs investment decisions, it informs policy decisions, it informs government decisions, it informs everything.
Yeah, what I don't get is when I hear people talking about, the Canucks, say, have never won at home against a certain team. I mean, how the hell do they remember that? You know?
Well, and that's the other thing. I mean, the average sports fan who calls into sports talk radio can rattle off the most amazing array of performance statistics. And yet, we don't ask for anything like that when it comes to, well, which pundits do you listen to and hold in high regard? You know, can we just bring that same level of rigor to these very much more important questions?
Yeah. So you've gotten to know Philip Tetlock. I guess we first sort of knew him through when he said facetiously that a chimp throwing darts is just as accurate as the average expert. So mm-hmm. Having written this book with him now and getting to know him, he seems like a fun guy. And is he fun to work with?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Phil is. The funny thing is, you're referring to his earlier research. He talked about he divided sort of expert forecasters into foxes and hedgehogs. Well, Phil is himself the exemplar of a fox. He's a very complex, nuanced thinker. And by the way, Phil actually would ask me to make one quick correction.
Sure.
He didn't actually say facetiously that the average expert was about as accurate as a dart throwing chimpanzee, because Phil is very much an evidence based guy.
Uh-huh.
That conclusion, that line, is actually the line that came out of his initial enormous 20-year research program. And at the end of that 20 years, after having studied the forecasts of some 280 experts, making 26,000 forecasts in total, that's actually the conclusion. The conclusion was that the average expert did basically no better than random guessing. Or, of course, the slightly more colorful way of expressing that is to say, no better than a dart-throwing chimpanzee.
Yeah.
But that was critically important to bear in mind. That wasn't just a facetious comment. That was actually the result of a very rigorous investigation.
And this Good Judgment Project, that began when?
Yeah, well, so what happened was Phil, his initial huge research program wrapped up, and he published the results of that in 2005, and that's the dart-throwing chimpanzee punchline. The timing is important, because what happens is in 2002, the U.S. intelligence community, you'll recall, infamously released a report saying it was a slam dunk. Well, they didn't use the word slam dunk, but that's what became attached to it. It was a slam dunk that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and would soon have nuclear weapons. And, of course, the subsequent 2003 invasion happened, and it turned out none of that was true. So the U.S. intelligence community, to its credit, was genuinely stunned by its failure and has really started to do some serious soul-searching about, how the heck did we get this so wrong and how can we be better? And one of the agencies of the U.S. intelligence community actually came to Phil and said, what about, say, a forecasting tournament? Now, a forecasting tournament, that makes it sound like a game.
Yeah.
It was, in the sense that it was competitive, but it was actually basically a whole bunch of interlocking research programs designed to try and find forecasting methods that work, figure out what works and what doesn't. And so what happened was, this agency, IARPA, they went to five leading researchers of forecasting. Those researchers set up five university-based research teams that would try and forecast the sorts of questions that intelligence analysts try and forecast, like will Greece default or will Russia annex the Crimea, that sort of thing. You know, big, important, and difficult questions. And one of those teams was the team led by Phil Tetlock and Barb Mellers, the Good Judgment Project. And that team, the core of it consisted of volunteers. They had, at any one time, between 2,600 and 3,000 volunteers, ordinary folks who just sat down and in their part time made forecasts. And then that team did extremely well. There was a whole bunch of different moving parts and components. Even just Phil's research program was very big and complex, and it did astonishingly well. In fact, it surpassed the benchmarks that were set by IARPA, far surpassed them, and they were very ambitious benchmarks. And it ended up basically being declared the winner of the forecasting tournament, and so over the course of 4 years, that research program continued, and a whole bunch of really interesting results came out of it. One of the most interesting, which is where the title of the book comes from, was the discovery of this very small stratum of top forecasters, or super forecasters. Again, just ordinary folks, but they were consistently excellent. They were so good, in fact, that the super forecasters actually beat intelligence analysts who had access to classified information. Mm. And if you think about that, that's truly amazing, because you're talking about literally ordinary folks who sit down at the kitchen table, pop open a laptop, and when they go to research a question, you know, they go to Google like anybody else, and that's their information source. And they actually beat these trained, highly trained professional analysts with access to classified information. So then the question, of course, becomes, well, what makes these extremely rare top forecasters so good? And that's what the book is about.
And so if you had to, I mean, there are a number of volunteers, hundreds, thousands even, right? A couple thousand? Yeah. If you had to look at the successful of them, in terms of personality, in terms of say, just their intellect. I mean, can you give us a sort of a sketch of who these folks are and what makes them so good?
Sure. So of course, all the volunteers in Phil's research program, and in all over the 4 years, it was something like 20,000 people were involved.
Mm-hmm.
They all had to go through a battery of tests, IQ tests, psychological personality tests, that's all that sort of thing. And so we, using that data, are able to determine sort of the correlates of excellent judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things you realize is, you might initially think, okay, you got some absolutely outstanding forecasters, maybe they're just like incredibly brilliant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And true enough, they are, in fact, more intelligent than the average person. They score higher on IQ tests, but they're not off the charts, right? They're not genius territory. And, of course, the other thing to bear in mind is that all of history is full of forecasts made by really smart people that flopped.
Mm-hmm.
So intelligence isn't enough. They're also, they're knowledgeable, they're numerate. But, again, these things, they're not off the charts. They're not freakishly so in any of those cases. And the other critical thing to bear in mind is they're not using computers and algorithms and arcane math. They are literally just like ordinary folks sitting, looking at the problem, doing the research, thinking hard about the problem, and then coming and making a subjective judgment. So then the question is, what does make that subjective judgment so good? Well, one of the critical components is something psychologists call active open-mindedness. They score very high in the active open-mindedness test, which is active open-mindedness is basically it's an approach to thinking that says basically when I have a conclusion, I think this is true. That's a hypothesis. It's not a conclusion. It's not something I can be just so confident in that I should guard it like a treasure. And of course, how does a scientist treat a hypothesis? A hypothesis is to be tested. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're constantly testing their own thinking. I think this is true. Okay, does this make sense? you know, if I poke it with a stick from this direction, does it still stand up? If I poke it with a stick from that direction, does it still stand up? That's the sort of person that we're talking about. That's how they approach this how they approach thinking. The other thing that's very important is they're the opposite of impulsive. In natural human decision-making, most people, when they have a strong intuitive sense that something is true, they'll simply go with it. They'll say, okay, you know, that's my final answer. These people are the exact opposite. They're slow, cautious, careful thinkers. They're constantly thinking on the one hand, on the other hand, on a third hand, on a fourth hand. You know, they keep at the analysis so long after most other people would give up. And that actually leads to another point, which is, well, these people are doing this voluntarily, and this is extremely hard work, and I want to emphasize that, right? This is not, they're not psychics, they're not pulling the stuff out of the air. This is the result of hard work. So why do they keep doing it? Well, they score very high in something psychologists call need for cognition. And need for cognition is basically how much you enjoy thinking. Mm-hmm. People who score high in need for cognition, they're puzzle solvers. They enjoy doing puzzles. And these people approach forecasting like a puzzle to be solved. And they keep at it because that's what they just enjoy doing. So that's another element. Yet another element is numeracy. I mentioned numeracy. Mm-hmm. And I also said that they're not using arcane math. So why does numeracy matter?
Yeah.
Well, it matters because typically what happens when people think about making a judgment about the future, they'll say, will it happen or will it not happen, right? That's your choice.
Yeah.
It will or it won't happen. And sometimes if you force them, you know, they'll acknowledge that there might be uncertainty, and we'll call that maybe. And so that's like they have a three-setting mental dial. It will happen, it won't happen, or maybe. Well, scientists approach thinking completely differently, and super forecasters use the sort of scientific approach. Scientists say, there's no such thing as certainty, first of all. Just drop certainty from your vocabulary. And if that's the case, then you drop it will or it won't from that dial, okay? Drop 100%, drop 0%. That leaves you with maybe. Now, of course, if you just say maybe over and over again, that's not terribly helpful. So what you want to do is you want to break maybe down into degrees of maybe. So that means 25%, 50%, 75%. But again, that's sort of a crude form of maybe. You can have finer and finer degrees of maybe. You can have 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, or you can have 10%, 15%, 20%, and so on. Or, if you're really, really good at this, you can have 10%, 11%, 12%. That's extremely fine, granular thinking. And this is called probabilistic thinking, right? Mm-hmm. It's emphasizing probability. There is no certainty. It's all a matter of probability. And these super forecasters are superb probabilistic thinkers. They do this almost habitually, quite contrary to what people normally do. So that's another element. And then another really key element is there's a mindset. A psychologist named Carol Dweck talks about the growth mindset, which is a belief that basically the more effort I put into something, the better I will get at it, which can sound like a truism, but you have to realize that, in fact, a lot of people don't believe that. They believe that somehow ability is an innate thing, right? And so when you try something and then you fail, well, now you know your limits, and so you give up. These people don't have that mentality. They have the growth mindset, and as a result, they keep pushing and trying and trying and trying, and they enjoy the practice aspect of it, and they enjoy getting the feedback. Did my forecast work or not? Did it not? Okay, what worked, what didn't work? So they're constantly practicing, and they're constantly improving. So it's sort of a constellation of both attitudes and behaviors. And ultimately, really, even, you know, you might think it's a question of, you know, well, it's a certain personality type. And I'm often asked that, is it a certain personality type? I actually don't think that that's what's important here.
Yeah.
Because whether you are naturally inclined to this sort of way of thinking or not isn't what ultimately determines whether you make the forecast or not, right? If you're naturally inclined to be a probabilistic thinker, a careful, rigorous, analytical thinker, but you don't actually make the effort to do that, then you're going to make a lousy forecast.
Right.
But if you're not naturally inclined to think this way, but you say to yourself, you know what, this forecast is important, I better kick myself and make the effort, then you will get the good forecast. So it's really a question of behavior, not personality.
And so these various traits, good leaders would do well to have them. And so why is it that in our political leadership, a lot of them don't?
Well, this is the big problem with the big problem with democracy, among other problems, is that we tend to reward the things that we shouldn't reward. We tend to reward the things that are not conducive to good judgment. So when a leader stands up and says, "This is an important problem, and I have the solution, and I am confident that it will work,"
Yeah. We
admire that. Right? Certainty. We're attracted to certainty, particularly when there's a big, important problem and we're faced with uncertainty. Psychologically, uncertainty is very aversive. We really don't like it. And someone who says, you know what, I'm certain and I can take away your uncertainty, that's very attractive. And so we reward the confident politician who says that. Whereas the politician who stands up and says, yep, this is an important problem and I think I have the solution, but I'm not sure, so let's experiment and see if it works. That is an illustration of exactly the kind of judgment that produces good results.
Mm-hmm.
But that politician will get pelted with rotten tomatoes because that's a risky experiment, and he's not sure, and maybe it won't work. We actually punish the very sort of thinking that produces good judgment, we collectively in the electorate. So it's really quite unfortunate. And you see it also in the media. The pundit who says, well, on the one hand, there's this factor. On the other hand, there's that other factor. And then there's a third factor. And balance of probabilities, it might go in this direction, but there's a lot of uncertainty here. You know, everyone says, oh, God, shut up. Remember Harry Truman's old joke? He said, he wanted to hear from a one-armed economist because he was sick of hearing on the one hand, on the other hand. That's human nature, right?
Yeah.
And so, but the pundit who comes along and says, this is the answer, boom, and then gives you a good story to explain why that is the correct answer, that's great. That gives us what we crave. That gives us the certainty that we crave, and so we reward it. So we seek out and listen to the people we shouldn't, and we don't seek out and we don't listen to the people that we should.
Now, someone like Dwight Eisenhower, who I know you have a great interest in, he as a general, you know, he exuded confidence to his troops, but you found that he had this intellectual humility, right?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, one of the great conundrums for any leader is how to square the circle. If you think that intellectual humility, which is absolutely the key phrase that sort of wraps up, it is the foundation of this super forecasting style of thinking. If you think that that's essential for good judgment, that's terrific. But now you've got to stand up and you've got to, you know, galvanize people. You've got to put together an organization. You've got to get people determined to succeed and try their hardest. And how do you lead? Well, you lead with confidence and certainty and vision and all those sorts of things, right? Which is, like, as I was just describing, that's the sort of thing that we reward as an electorate. Well, that's there for a very good reason. And anybody who's ever been in a leadership position knows that people are looking, particularly in a highly uncertain situation in which they're afraid, they're looking to you, and they want to see that sort of confidence. And so the question is, how do you square that circle? How do you maintain the style of thinking that is necessary for good judgment while simultaneously doing those things that you have to do to be a good leader? And Dwight Eisenhower was a terrific example of this. He, in his gut, absolutely was one of these people who said there's nothing certain in life. And he proceeded on the basis of intellectual humility. The very first thing that he did after ordering the D-Day invasion was he went off by himself and sat down and wrote out a note that was to be released in the event of failure. Mm-hmm. And it took personal responsibility for the failure of D-Day. That meant it was absolutely in Dwight Eisenhower's heart. He knew, felt it in his heart that things could go wrong, that this could fail. You know, he smoked four packs of cigarettes a day for a reason. And in fact, in private, he was known to be quite moody and grumbly and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But in public, any time he ever dealt with his troops, he didn't stand up and say falsely, you know, I'm certain we're going to win. He didn't talk boastfully. He didn't, lie, basically. But what he did do was demonstrate an example of calm. Calm confidence. So no matter if the situation got grimmer and more uncertain, he would become more calm and more confident. So he wasn't betraying intellectual humility. He wasn't betraying his fundamental understanding of the nature of reality, but he was projecting the confidence that the people around him needed to have. And you find that in so many good leaders.
Has writing this book, and not only this book, but Future Babble even, has that changed your own thinking? Because we used to see on TV a lot, you know, waxing punditry and the sort.
Absolutely. In fact, I think it would be fair to say that for many years I was a newspaper columnist,
yeah.
Writing three columns a week, and I think it would be fair to say that I am actually incapable of doing that work now, because I don't think anybody wants to read a column in which somebody lays out the factors for and against and then says, what's the answer? I don't know. Three times a week. So I actually, you know, it has absolutely profoundly changed how I, you know, as fundamentally as how I see reality, how I make decisions, how I think. In the book we describe John Maynard Keynes, and Keynes's great strength and what he was most proud of was his willingness to say, I guess my earlier thinking was wrong, I'm going to change my mind in light of new evidence. And I really have learned through this work to admire that sort of thinking, and in particular to admire the person who has the courage to say, I don't know. Because those are, in fact, if you understand human psychology, the hardest words for a human being to say, I don't know. It takes courage and intellectual honesty to say that.
Yeah, you know how I noticed that I hadn't seen you on TV for a while was I saw you promote this book on a show, and your hair was different. And I remember a lot of people back in the day used to comment about your hair.
Well, you know, it worked for Justin Trudeau, so.
But you had a head of hair back then that a lot of people coveted.
Apparently.
Yeah. Do you get asked about Margaret Wente a lot?
A little bit now and then, sure.
Yeah. I was just wondering that, you know. But this is such a great book, Dan, and it's an engaging one, and I could talk with you for hours on it. I've enjoyed the book and the conversation as usual. This is a fine achievement. Congratulations, and continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
The website, dangardner.ca. The book is called Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. It's published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. It's co-author Dan Gardner joined me on the line from Ottawa and Vancouver. I'm Joel Suplenta.